Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to Text Message. I'm Nate Langson.
And I'm Ian Morris.
And we are...
And that intro was the shortest intro on earth.
It was
like, there'll be no humour today. Straight to business.
Pretty much. Pretty much, but that's kind of the point. I hate podcasts with loads of faff at the beginning.
There is that. That's true, yes, yeah.
It's pointless. But we are going to get on with the news, and we're going to talk specifically this week, maybe to some detail about Netflix. We did talk about Netflix last week for completely different reasons, although they may, on some level, be connected. This is the news that Netflix is looking to crack down on proxy streaming. What's proxy streaming, you may be asking inside your head? What this is where you use a VPN service. I use one called AirVPN. Ian undoubtedly has one as well. And it does one of two things. One thing it does is it encrypts your traffic, which makes it harder for people spying on a local public Wi-Fi network to look at what's being transmitted from your computer or to your computer, which is very good for privacy reasons. And the other thing that it often does is it allows your computer to tell a server that it is in a country that it is, in fact, not in. A good use for this, and one of the things I use it for, is if I'm traveling outside of the UK and I want to access the BBC iPlayer, I can't. But I can use my VPN to use a server located in the UK to tunnel my traffic through. Therefore, the BBC thinks I am in the UK. And I personally think this is a fine thing to do because I am a legitimate user of the BBC iPlayer. However, this is where the controversy comes in. It is possible to do this for Netflix as well. And Netflix around the world has many, many different local catalogs of TVs and movies. TV shows and movies, but some countries have, you know, only a fraction, sometimes as little as 10% as what its primary catalog in the US has. This means that it's very, very tempting to sign up for Netflix in one country, but use a VPN to use the catalog of another country's that maybe has more to watch that you want to watch than your local catalog has. Before now, Netflix has not really cracked down on this. They've not really, you know, made a big stink about it, but now that it's going to be in 130 countries worldwide, it seems that part of its deals with many of the content providers that it has deals with is that it has to crack down on this. Now, we don't exactly know how it's going to crack down on this, do we, Ian? But
no.
All we know is that it wants to, and I've got a couple of suggestions
I don't think it does want to, actually. I think it's being made to, but that's fine. That was inevitable.
Yes, I mean, there was a quote from the CEO of Netflix, Reed Hastings, that said, if all our content were globally available, there wouldn't be a reason for members to use proxies or unblockers to fool our systems into thinking they're in a different country than they're actually in. In the meantime, and that word, meantime, is a key one, I think, we will continue to respect and enforce content licensing by geographic location. So the two key points in that, as I see it, is that they are bound by licensing restrictions, which we know, and this happens in music as well. This is why sometimes you can go to iTunes to buy a song from a tweet from an artist, and it says, sorry, this release is not available in your country. These are artificial, digitally enforced restrictions that are something of a business hangover from, you know, back when record labels could just release the record in a country. And they've kind of followed into the digital age with some controversy attached. And the meanwhile is the other part, or in the meantime of his quote, because as you say, you don't think they want to. And hopefully they are pushing to have a universal catalog, which would be better for everyone, including the rights holders, who would, you know, get more access to customers, which would be fantastic.
Yeah, and this is it's the core issue, really, isn't it? And I have some sympathy for Netflix because I know that they must be under enormous pressure from the companies that they do business with every day to stamp this sort of proxying out. And obviously, when you're under pressure like that, it makes doing deals a lot harder, and that means that prices go up, and that means that their service becomes quite difficult to manage. But what I mean, I have used a proxy a couple of times for things like Hulu and stuff like that, but never really exhaustively, because ultimately I don't really need to. If I can't find it on Netflix or Amazon, I'd be much more inclined to download it through another method, I would say. And I think that's the problem, really. I think rights holders need to get to grips with pretty quickly is that, you know, Netflix said at their press conference at CES, if you give customers a fair price, and then, you know, they'll take it every time over piracy. And they gave some statistic about managing to get piracy down on one particular title by 14% in Australia. And I just thought, well, that is actually a proper number. It's not by 0.4% or something like that. You know, they actually, having stuff readily available is the cornerstone of cutting down piracy. And if it's not available on Netflix or Amazon or, you know, say another service, I mean, there are other options out there, aren't there? We talked about Crunchyroll last week. Then it becomes very difficult and annoying, doesn't it, for the consumer?
It really does. And at the moment, because we want to focus on the UK aspect on this, the numbers, the most recent numbers I could find suggest that the UK has about half the total catalogue of Netflix in the US. And there are some shows, TV programs and movies that are available in the UK that are not available in the US.
Absolutely.
This isn't that the US has everything, but and every other country just has some subset of that group. There are many that are not available in the US because of, again, rights holders in the UK here.
I was going to say, one of the problems is that I think there's a real problem with expectations of customers. And we're going to have to get used to the fact that for the kind of money that Netflix charges every month, we are never going to have a service that has every film and TV series that we want on it. It's just
Why?
Not possible. Because it's just not possible. You could not do those deals, I don't think. It would be, first of all, it would be extraordinarily time consuming to do. And I think that stuff will always get left aside. But second of all, I just don't really think it's enough money for them to be able to do it. I mean, as the service grows, perhaps that will be, but won't be an issue. But you're talking about doing a deal globally for content, and that's, you know, that's really expensive.
If the movie industry, the TV industry, the music industry, if they ever want to truly crack down on piracy to the point that it has basically mitigated the consequence of any piracy, then you do need to have worldwide deals. Now, I agree with what you're saying. It can't happen because worldwide deals can't happen right now. But then let's think 15 years ago, we wouldn't have thought that we could ever have DRM-free downloads of songs or streaming catalogs that are fully legitimate. I mean, these are deals that do take a long, long time to create.
Well, to be honest with you, yes, you're right, of course. And for a business like Netflix, it makes a huge amount of sense for them to talk globally. And actually, it probably would be that relatively easy. What you got to consider about the deals that movie studios particularly do, and of course this applies for TV as well, is that movies cost a lot of money, and that money obviously has to be there up front. And that's one of the reasons they do distributor deals. So they say, well, look, we can't afford to give you the full $100 million for this movie because we aren't sure, it may be a flop. It's a huge risk for one company to take. So they do a deal with a distributor and they say, well, you give us X million and we'll, you know, then that'll be your movie to distribute globally. It might be one of those, or, you know, in other regions, it might be one of those things where they have to start being just a little bit more clever about how they negotiate those deals. It might be that, you know, if you're in for, you know, you might get cinema revenue, but they would exclude you from revenue after that, you know, so, you know, DVD and all that kind of stuff. Or maybe they increase the amount of money or increase the share you get if you finance when you sell on DVD or something. There must be a way of, you know, making it up. Or maybe we're going to see these sort of distributors go away a bit and, you know, and companies will, movie studios will just self-fund. But I think that would be bad, because what it will lead to is the thing that people say they hate about movies, which is, you know, Avengers 4 and, you know, and films where there's very little imagination shown in the creation, and it you just get the same thing over and over again, and remakes of things, you know, Ghostbusters remade with ladies and things like that. I mean, not that I object to that particular example, but, you know, other things where really, you know, Point Break, why are we remaking Point Break, really?
Let's talk a bit about how a circumvention of VPNs could be possible. Now, the way that I see it is that one thing Netflix has above all else is a pay model, which means that you have to pay for Netflix. Even if you have a free trial, you have to register. And that means they know at least the country most likely to be the one that you are in. Because most people, and I would imagine the overwhelming vast majority of people who use Netflix, are at least paying for it using, you know, their local credit card. You know, they're not signing up with a US credit card or some sort of alternative. You can do that with iTunes by putting in creating an iTunes US store account and buying a US iTunes voucher, applying it, downloading the DRM-free versions, and then, you know, downloading them on your local machine. You can do that. Netflix is harder to do because it's all streaming, so you have to be connected to the service. And it may say, well, you're only going to get access to the account from the country within which your payment method is registered.
Now, I understand that they have said they're not going to do that. Or they haven't said they aren't going to do it, but they haven't said they are.
Well, that's interesting if they're not, because that's, to me, seems like the most logical way.
Yes.
The other way that I was going to suggest, which seems less robust but could be done, is you choose the country upon sign-up and you're not allowed to change it, which would at least mean that while you can choose to use the US Netflix, you can't change it back to the UK one if something that you want comes up on the UK store.
I've just done a spine shudder because it's reminding me of Blu-ray region coding and DVD coding.
And DVD region coding.
Yeah, which is, you know, a shower of excrement.
Yes, and Nintendo cartridge thing, which was also, quote-unquote, a thing.
Really, I mean, goodness gracious me. The gaming thing, though, that's particularly obnoxious. It would be enforceable to some extent. Certainly, the easiest way, and probably the best way, and the most watertight way, would be to do as you say, to tie the location that you're coming from to the credit card you registered with. And to say, well, okay, you may be in the US at the moment on holiday, say, but we're still going to deliver you your UK library because that's your primary account. But they haven't said they're doing that. We will find out in a few weeks' time whether that is what they're going to do. And they may do, but I don't think... The thing is, I honestly don't believe their heart's in it at all anyway. So I just don't think so. What I suspect could happen is there will be services will spring up that will get around that anyway. So even if you have an account in the UK, I suspect maybe they do a switching thing. So maybe you sign up with someone and, you know, your accounts are sort of merged electronically in the cloud, and then you both get access to both sides of the Atlantic, say. So that would be one particular service that you could operate. There already are services, you know, you linked in our shared document for this podcast, you know, a summary of what you can see all over the world on Netflix. And there are linked there services which do exactly that. In fact, one that I was just told about today, purely coincidental by somebody else, merges every catalogue on Netflix global. So you can see anything from anywhere in the world. And that's quite interesting, isn't it? Because that gives you one hell of a service.
It does, and that would also show you where the discrepancies are between the two services.
Yes, absolutely, and that's useful in itself. And one of the things I have a real problem with, and this is, you know, it's a silly problem, really, is that Netflix isn't really that searchable, is it? And neither is Amazon. I don't think I want to watch something on Netflix tonight. I think I'd love to see X film. I wonder if it's on Netflix or Amazon, and then I have to go through with my clicker and search every blinking service to find out if it's on there or not. Really, I want to have a better way of doing that, and, you know, and so that's one way of doing it, isn't it? But that's a tangential point.
It is a tangential point. I don't necessarily know how long such a restriction will remain in enforcement for Netflix, because, as you say, they don't want to do it, and customers don't want to do it, and there's undoubtedly data somewhere that shows that doing it is detrimental to business as well.
Probably.
So I think this is probably a stopgap to allow them to launch worldwide, and eventually the sheer might and power of Netflix will allow them to strike deals that were previously unattainable.
Don't forget as well, I genuinely believe, and this applies to me, I genuinely do not think that many people do this. I don't think VPN use is huge. I can tell you that most of the people that I know personally who've used VPNs do so because they're expats. So they've moved to, say, the US and they want to keep up with iPlayer, or maybe want to stream football from Sky. That's the most often case you hear about. But people actually wanting to switch to a, you know, to see a different film, I just don't think it's that common.
No, I use it for almost entirely legitimate reasons, I would like to think. I use it when I'm abroad. I travel a lot, and I use it to watch the BBC iPlayer, and I use it to watch Netflix when I'm in the US, and sometimes I do want the UK catalog, but I have on occasion been known to use VPNs to access the US catalog when something's disappeared from the UK one. Mm. And again, I'm paying for Netflix. I'm not trying to steal money from them. No. I just want to access content that physically exists on a server.
You can't do it on Amazon, you'll know. It's impossible.
That's because I don't use it.
Well, no, but if you did, you'd know that you can't do it.
But until then, I'll just have to remain confident that I do not care. Well, this week was a little bit dry in terms of very UK-specific technology, but one thing that was enormously impressive and very exciting for everyone who is interested in space was Commander Tim Peake. Is he commander? Is he captain? Major?
I don't know, actually. Yeah, that's a good point, isn't it? British, he's something.
Yeah, British astronaut Tim Peake made his first spacewalk. He is the first official British astronaut to go in residence on the International Space Station. And firstly, well done, him, and well done, us. Let's pat ourselves on the back. I admit my contribution to his space life has been minimal at best, but I like to believe, like all football teams refer to their teams as we, even though they sat in a chair, drank beer in a pub, I believe we have achieved something great. And I know that you had some experience with one of your kids getting very excited about this too, Ian. Why do you find this so particularly interesting?
Well, this is the thing. So I tweeted about this in the week because actually it's quite easy to dismiss, you know, especially with our meagre space budget, to dismiss it as being unimportant. But actually it's really important. And Izzy, my daughter's been at school. They've had a space week. They've been doing show and tell with space stuff. Izzy made a little comet, which I thought was absolutely adorable. Teacher loved it and stuff. And she was really excited about it. And then when she came home on Friday after doing her little presentation to the class, she told me the name of the person that was in, you know, Tim Peake in space. And I just, I just think it's extremely important if we're going to have any chance at all of encouraging our kids into, you know, STEM subjects, then we need to have them excited about science. And there's nothing more exciting than seeing a man with a Union flag on his arm doing a selfie in space. And I'm looking at it now and it's cool, man. It's really cool. Even though taking photos in space is nothing new particularly, and people doing spacewalks is nothing new, it's just cool. It always makes me smile when I see a photo from space, and this one just happens to have a dude from Britain on, and it's cool.
That is absolutely fantastic. And that just reminds me that the last thing that I watched on Netflix using the VPN to access the US catalog was the remake of Cosmos.
Ah.
Which was absolutely fantastic, and I love that.
That, I don't believe, has been shown in this country, has it? So there's a good example of something, actually.
Yeah. And I'm gonna buy it on iTunes just to show my support, because I think it was fantastic, as was indeed the original.
With Neil, the remake was Neil deGrasse Tyson, wasn't it?
It's wonderful how it encapsulates the sentiment of the original. I think it was very, very, very good. And it's
Carl Sagan's his
hero.
Yeah, exactly. And they were good friends, I think. So
it was fantastic. Yeah. But maybe that's something that you should watch with your daughter if she's interested.
Yeah,
and certainly,
absolutely,
mate, I can lend you many books. If you like photos from space, then wait till you find a book of photos from space.
Oh, brilliant. I should get Izzy one, really. Because the thing is, it seems perhaps unimportant. I mean, you know, space is always going to be cool. But you never know. You never know what thing it is you say to a kid that makes them realise they want to do something, you know. And, you know, I don't mind what she does, but if she happens to be into science in some way, that'd be awesome.
Mm. Well, well done, Tim Peake, from all of us, by which I mean Ian and I, a text message. Well, we've got one last little thing we wanted to get to this week, and this is another pseudo-television, or in fact, it's entirely television-related.
We're now at the mercy of machines, and a battle the likes of which we've never seen before is about to begin.
Robot Wars is coming back to its spiritual and indeed actual home, the BBC. This is brilliant. We recently watched some of the original Robot Wars episodes that were hosted by none other than Jeremy Clarkson,
yeah,
initially, looking at some sort of faux Top Gear-esque goth in a full-on leather trench coat and what looks suspiciously like those enormous boots, New Rocks. They're called New Rock boots that a lot of goths wear, and there is a chance that I once previously owned a pair. And this is great news. The show's coming back. This is where robots of increasing style and brutality beat each other up with forks and kitchen implements and various other things, at least based on the original. It was a little bit underwhelming, I have to say, watching the original recently, that they didn't really do anything. Like the house robots, things like Sir Kill-a-Lot and a bunch of the others, they had pretty badass weaponry, but the contenders were, you know, some of them had a spike that went forwards very quickly, and they were essentially just slightly more violent remote control cars. but as, you know, tradition suggests, when things get re-brought back, they come back with a bit of extra budget for something like this, and they're building or at least creating an entirely new custom-built studio with new state-of-the-art cameras, I read somewhere, to capture the action close
up.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Is fantastic.
Well, it is, because obviously, you know, the original was a long time ago and camera technology was, you know, poor, really. And now you can put a camera on anything, can't you? And you can get a really nice picture out of it. So it will add a certain dimension to it. It's not the be-all and end-all.
Yeah.
But one of the interesting things, I had a thought, actually, as I was reading the news, and I was thinking, why was it called Robot Wars? They weren't really robots, were they? And you just said exactly the same thing. You know, they're basically, as Jeremy Clarkson would say, you know, remote control cars on acid or something like that.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's more like car pushing and shoving. But yeah, you wouldn't get it past a commissioning editor at the BBC in 1998 saying, what we're going to do is we're going to put some, you know, like little radio-controlled cars. We're going to strap knives to the front and drive them into each other. They'd say that sounds quite a lot like bumper cars.
And yes,
and also
very boring.
That's not a thing.
But when it comes back, what they should absolutely do, and this was one of the problems with Robot Wars towards the end, as you probably remember, and one of the reasons I think it ended up getting cancelled, was that there would just be a certain amount that you could do that would make your robot undefeatable. And the house robots were largely undefeatable, weren't they? And that's fine to some extent, because, you know, they played it well, they were timed, they weren't always out. But what would be awesome this time round is if they said, well, you know, you have to pre-program, or it has to be a robot in the sense that it makes decisions as it's going, and perhaps a portion of that would be, so you'd either have, it would either drive based on robotic decisions, or it would, its weaponry would work that way. So that basically you have to have some real skill, you have to program it right, you have to turn it into an actual robot in order to, and I'm, you know, maybe that's a little bit too highbrow kind of thing, but, you know, it would make it a bit more interesting, I think.
Indeed, and hopefully Philippa Forrester will come back and grace us with her presence for the reboot. Anyway, that's going to do it for this week's show. I don't believe we have a date yet for the reboot of the thing that I just said. That
summer, I think.
Summer, is it?
I believe so. Or later in the year, I think, was the actual date they gave.
I see. Okie dokie.
And it's only 6 episodes, and it's an hour.
Yes. I did read somewhere that one of the original contenders wants to come back to make a new robot and rebattle, which would be quite interesting to see the pardon me, do you remember the one that was sort of coated in sort of red and white felt and went up against one of the robots with a flamethrower?
Yeah.
And the drivers on the team all wore waistcoats made out of the same felt, and I can just remember then and when I rewatched it recently thinking, why on earth would you put felt on a robot, particularly when you're putting your robot in front of fire?
Yes, and the inevitable did happen, didn't it?
Well,
it
yes,
caught
it got,
fire.
It got burnt off.
Yeah.
And then you had to spend 30 seconds on the television explaining how that was a disappointment. Frankly, I wish it had happened sooner. Anyway, that's going to do it. Thank you, everyone, for your reviews. I mean, we are well over the 100 five-star review mark in iTunes, but as ever, now is the time to continue leaving them. We love them. They help us get seen and noticed. It's more use to us and certainly more appreciated than any kind of financial donation. Even though we did have somebody write in recently to say that if we did open up the donation box, they'd be happy to donate. All we want is...
That's very kind, isn't it?
It is, indeed.
At least it makes you realise that you're appreciated, even if we aren't particularly interested in it.
Yeah, I mean, it's word of mouth and a good review goes a very long way, and thank you. And keep the emails coming in, podcast@natelangson.com. We want to hear your thoughts. Do you remember Robot Wars? Philippa Forrester, Jeremy Clarkson, got some memories. Put them on the back of a postcard, shove them towards us. We'll look at them, won't we, Ian? And we'll talk
about
them.
Yes, we will, of course. Yeah, I'd love to read feedback.
Yes, indeed. And until next time, toodle pip.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.